Okay, thank you. So, thank you for the invitation to be here. Wow, that light is bright. I have to stand at the side. So, I'm going to tell you about a phenomenon which is a rather strange one, in that it could have been predicted by Rayleigh in about 1890 or something. Now, there's no physics which is newer than 1890 in this. And he could have done the experiments, because there's no experimental technique which is really newer than than 1890 either. But it wasn't done, and fortunately there's still some little bits at the bottom of the barrel which we can scratch out. Now, I discovered this phenomenon when I was working with a graduate student of mine on crystal growth. We were working on dendritic growth, and we wanted to find a way of growing three-dimensional dendritic crystals with no specific orientation. That is, you have to levitate them. Now, one way which Glaxman did was to send these out into space and grow them out on the space shuttle, that's one way you could do it. And another way which we thought of trying would be a drop tower, but the crystals don't grow fast enough. There's a beautiful drop tower in Cleveland where you get about 2 or 3 seconds of drop. And it's actually microgravity more than anything else is. It's better than even the space shuttle. If there are no vibrations or anything, this thing drops down a vacuum tube, a evacuated tube, which is a kilometer high or something like that, and you get really good microgravity, but only for a short time. And then we thought, well, we haven't got all these possibilities, so we'll do it by levitating, by hydrodynamic levitation of the crystal while it's growing. And what do I do? I press this. I have to keep out of the way of the light because it's very bright. What do I press? That's it. So this was the way we thought of doing the levitation.
It's a pointer down.
Ah.
Send above everyone.
Yeah, dangerous, you know. If anybody asks questions which I don't like. So the idea was very simple. You take a tube of fluid, you rotate the fluid contains, in this case, supersaturated solution. You rotate the fluid, rotate it about a horizontal axis, which goes to the center here, and then you have the Stokes force going up and the weight going down. And if you're lucky, you'll trap a crystal at this point, and then it will grow in the fluid, and it will stay there, supported by the fluid for as long as you like. The only question was whether this is a stable point or an unstable point. Well, it actually experimentally turned out to be stable. I never quite convinced myself that it really ought to be stable, but anyhow, the crystals grew there very beautifully, and we got a lot of results in about 19. No, they stay there, and it's another film which I could have put on this. It's just showing this crystal happily sitting there for, it sat there for hours, just as long as you like. And you can grow the crystals that way. So you rely on nucleation of one crystal. And of course, this happens at a certain point, and then other crystals will nucleate afterwards. But by using clean fluids, you wait a long time, and then one crystal will nucleate, and it gets trapped in this point, this fixed point, and it remains there, and we grow the crystal. It works, and experimental evidence.
I don't understand. The necessary force depends on the mass.
Yes.
So how do you
Oh, it adjusts its position. The radius, you see the upward force is the Stokes force, this thing which is approximately like that, depends on the radius. Ah. Yes, so the crystal just moves radially outwards as it gets heavier. It doesn't. It's attracted to the equilibrium. Yes, no, not completely. It's not completely understood, but you'll see later that when you have more than one, they can't all be in the same place. They actually go into stable orbits around that point. And so this worked very nicely. But anyhow, as we continued the experiments, you would eventually get several crystals nucleating, and then you get an effect which looks like. It's water. It's supersaturated solution of ammonium chloride, which is more or less water. It's not very viscous, no. No, that's the wrong one. Hey, what do I... Oh, there it is. Sorry? Yes, without writing down any equations for this, actually it's all been done now. It's all been done by, there's a paper by Rayberg which actually does a full analysis of the whole of this process. Which I'll show you the reference shortly. It appears on this. So anyhow, this was the way which we grew the crystals, and they grew very nicely. And this is the apparatus which all these experiments are done in. Same piece of apparatus. Two bearings, a horizontal tube, except that we now have a situation of changing the length of the tube by a plunger which goes inside it. But otherwise, that's the apparatus which is referred to. Well, horizontal is the horizontal axis you've got there, and this is the end view, so the horizontal is here. And I think I've just changed the direction of omega, I think, from one of these. The dotted line is the rotation axis, that's right.
No, I don't know. Here, the rotation axis is
perpendicular to the plane. Here, yes. This is the end view. That's it, that's right. The rotation axis, this is the rotation axis here, and the rotation axis goes through there, normal to the plane.
Why is it a long?
Yes, it's a long tube, long tube.
Why is it a long tube?
Well, now you'll see. You'll see why it's a long tube.
Now, in terms of the crystal growth experience, yes. Of course, the environment is not the same as in space.
No, that's right. This is actually, it doesn't simulate the convection free flow, because it's a, so it's not the same experiment, but it was a similar experiment. So, that's what I've just told you, so there's no need to say any more. But this is what happened when we got a lot of crystals in the tube. After a while, you get more nucleation points and more nucleation points, and eventually you get a lot of crystals. And we've discovered that they separate into bands. Now, I suggest you notice, I've written it up there, that the separation of the bands is approximately equal to the diameter of the tube. And just remember that, because afterwards you'll see that this changes. But it's approximately equal to the diameter of the tube. And you get these very nice bands, and this was in 1991, 92, when we did these experiments. And you know, I thought, well, this is a nice, there must be an explanation for this, but I don't know what it is. And since I was working on crystal growth and not on the hydrodynamics, I put it on one side and didn't actually forget about it, because eventually I did come back to it. Wait. I'll show you in a moment. This is a broken symmetry, that's right. So, now, when we use larger particles, those were crystals of various sizes, no particular control over them. So we started to do some, and this was only a couple of years ago now, that we decided, got a graduate student looking for a problem, and we thought, well, here, we'll have this one waiting for 10 years. And there was nothing, no one had published anything on this subject at all. We looked carefully in all the literature. Nothing that ever, either observations or theory or anything, had been published. There are granular mixtures, dry granular mixtures. I've worked ourselves on the dry granular mixtures, but not on. They're free surface effects, and this sort had not been seen in the fluid. So I gave it to a graduate student to work on, and he started doing some careful experiments in which we wanted to see whether the particle shape was important, its size was important, and so on. So he made up, actually turned on the lathe, a lot of little cylinders, and we found spheres and so on. No dependence on the shape whatsoever. But he found that the separation, now notice here, the separation is about twice the diameter of the tube, not the diameter of the tube as it was before. There's a factor of two that comes in here. You'll see later it's exactly the factor of two that's involved. And now it turned out that the rate of rotation was not very important here. You could vary it within quite a large range, no difference in the results, until you start centrifuging the particles out at one end. And the onset comes when they don't lift off the ground. They just sit on the bottom of the tube. But as soon as they lift off, they go into this fairly quickly, move into this. This is pure water, virtually no viscosity. We have recently increased the viscosity to see how it changes, and you in fact get the change from this period to half the period when it starts to get viscous, and that's why it depends on the ratio between the particle size and the depends on the particle size. The particles are very small, you get twice as many bands. You get a band here and here and here. So, but let's...
Can you density match the fluid?
Yeah, if you density match them, you do this automatically. We tried increasing the viscosity on these, which are plexiglass cylinders. And very soon you get to the point where you put in glycerol, and the glycerol solution matches the plexiglass, and then it all vanishes.
It all goes away.
So, this is what it looks like from the end. Question, okay? So this is just like the thought we got for the crystals when you got too many of them. But see, because they couldn't all be at on the neutral axis, then they go round the neutral axis, and there you can see what it looks like. We actually, some of these particles were just painted black, so we could actually measure the rate of rotation. The rate of rotation is marginally smaller than the rate of rotation of the tube. It's close to it, but a little bit smaller, which is also relevant to what I have to say later on. Okay, so this was the dependence on the parameters. It doesn't depend on the shape or size of the particles within the region we were working in, that's large particles. It doesn't depend on the frequency of rotation. It doesn't depend on the viscosity. When the centrifugal force is so large that it throws out the higher density particles to the surface of the tube. And another thing which we noticed that it's observed also for bubbles. So bubbles have negative buoyancy, but if you go back to the picture with the bands, bands with the plexiglass particles, the bubbles form bands exactly in between the particles. So you have a band of particles, band of bubbles, band of particles, band of bubbles, and so on. And that's it. So just some of the hydrodynamic numbers for those who understand these things. The Reynolds number 100 to 300, a very difficult region, because it's not the viscous, low Reynolds number region, it's not a high Reynolds number. So it's theory is probably going to be difficult for it. The viscous forces are negligible compared with Coriolis forces. That's essentially why when you go over the boundary of that being of the order 1, then you get twice as many bands. And the Rossby number, which is the relationship between the nonlinear terms and the linear terms, is only about 0.5, which means that probably a nonlinear theory is important here. You can't really neglect the nonlinear terms. And that's, I think, also relevant to the continuation. So, I have summarized here all the papers we could find on this sort of problem. A similar banding, the two papers which we published on it are down here. But notice there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 starting with observation. These are my remarks, these aren't the names of the papers. 5 which are observations, and 1 which is theory. And in fact, while we started this work, to our great surprise, because it's been around for such a long time, such a simple experiment and so on, we were amazed to see suddenly the other people working on the same subject, immediately starting at the same time. I don't know why this happened, but anyhow, somehow. So the observation of banding of silica particles in glycerol solutions, that's the low Reynolds number region. Experiments published in 2003, but we saw this as a preprint considerably earlier. In fact, a theory to explain that was produced by Lee and Ladd, you see, before the experiment was published. And that's, although it again refers to the preprint of the experiment, this theory, I believe, is completely wrong, but it is a pattern formation theory with linear instability and so on. And yes. Yes, I'm sorry. Yes?
Okay. It shows that these bands are formed.
in those situations, somehow it's a more stable thing for the particles if they are aligned behind each other.
Oh, I'm sorry, I missed that because
I mean, if you go into this,
yes.
Because if we leave the big guy, they already form something like a chain, then a particle will move out and we need to get extra energy.
I see.
Push
okay, well, we'll discuss that afterwards because I could. I didn't know about that. Well, that's like birds also.
Explanation what I mean is that yes.
Okay, you'll. Okay, let's talk about that afterwards because you'll see that our theory goes in a completely different direction. And then this is an observation of, again, banding with sand in water, which is rather similar results to what to ours. Again, there's no, here you see there's quite a large density difference between the sand and the water, and the no particular definition of the size of the particles, but the work in this paper essentially concentrates on that orbit, which I just showed you a moment ago, the circular orbit, and defining that quite accurately. It doesn't discuss the banding process itself. Then these are the two papers in which we published. I thought originally that it was to do with the crystal growth process, because we'd seen it in crystal growing, and until I did more experiments on it, discovered it had nothing to do with crystal growth whatsoever. But here, I still thought that it was something to do with the crystal growth, and we were looking, together with Victor Steinberg, on possibilities of setting up a sort of Rayleigh-Benard sort of effect because of the different densities of the solution before and after growing the crystal started to nucleate. Then we discovered, essentially because of the bubbles, you see the bubbles band as well. That has nothing to do with the particle, the crystal growth, and the definition of a very well-defined wavelength suggested that maybe it's a wave-particle interaction mechanism. And another thing which everybody quotes in this field is bands which are formed where there's a free surface in the solution, in the mixture. And there, I think this is more like the dry matter. Experiments where you get two different types of sand together and they separate as in the same rotation system. That was published in 1999. So you can see that all the things are very recent, which is surprising considering that all the physics is really very old. The new thing which we did first was to look at how it depended on the tube length, and this really gives it away as being a wave mechanism, that we measured the period of the bands, that's big lambda, divided by the radius of the tube, as a function of the length divided by the radius of the tube. That means that we did it with different sized tubes, and all the points fall on the same lines. You get a series of lines like this, which means that it's something which likes to be around, let's say, the 3.7, about 3.6 or something like that, but is influenced by the length of the tube. There's a very strong influence of the length of the tube. And this is just like a laser resonator, where you have an amplification band, that is, a certain wavelength is the best one for amplification, with the wavelengths around that band, around that frequency, and then the exact frequency you get is determined by the length of the resonator. And then you get a picture which is almost identical with this. We looked at models for laser resonators, you get the same diagram. And it's schematically, that diagram is like this. So you get a series of straight lines, each one representing a number of half waves in the length of the laser resonator. The amplification region is here, and so what you actually see is these. Now, when the tube is very short, so you'll get a small number of wavelengths, in fact, there'll be regions where there's no amplification. It's just exactly the same as we see here. When the tube is very short, sometimes you don't get this effect. But when you make it long enough, there will always be a solution. Essentially, from here onwards, you can see that point and this one are one over the other, so that there's always a solution. And then, in fact, the ratio here starts to get narrower, gets more well-defined. So that seems to fit some wave mechanism. And so I went around asking people about waves. But the other thing which we noticed is as follows. Maybe I didn't. Now, how do I go back with this? Page up. I just want to go. This picture here. Notice on this. Yes, there will be multiple solutions, and it gets a bit messy when you go to very large numbers. But for the numbers which we work with, it's fairly the results are quite clean. Notice that this band, I wrote it in red and then forgot to mention it. This band is at the end of the tube. This band is half a wave before the end of the tube. And so it seems that the boundary conditions at the end, if they exist, don't mind whether it's a band or not a band. And it could be one or the other. This means that this picture could just as well be with a band here, a band here, and a band at the end here. They're completely symmetrical. And
I'm wondering about the position of those graphs of lambda versus L.
Yes.
So what exactly is lambda?
Lambda is the distance we measure.
I know what roughly it is.
Yeah.
What exactly?
How we measure it exactly. What you do is to take a lot of pictures of this sort, and you draw out the density of particles as a function of distance, averaged over the whole of the tube, and then you fit over the vertical picture here, and then you determine the maximum density there, and you find the distance between them. So that's how you do it quite accurately.
No, but there's not a single thing.
No,
the set of
distances, but they're constant.
Well, they're not. I mean, the question is that graph.
This one.
Result,
yes.
Looks much more precise than the phenomena, and I wonder what kind of. There's some underlying variability in the average.
Yes, that's right. But that's with as you do an experiment during the time, you sample that underlying variability a lot, so that if you continue to take data for quite a long time, then average it, you can get a very accurate determination of the period of the thing. I think that's right. No, we don't fit it to it. Fitting to a cosine is a very poor way of doing it. What you actually get is a fairly well-defined band. We actually fit it to a Gaussian. Each band is fitted to a Gaussian independently because they're well separated. Then you can find the maximum of the Gaussian accurately and so on. And this is what is plotted here.
Can you take the argument of both space and time?
Both space and time, yes. And this, in fact, because I've divided by the radius here, you can see that this also shows you that it's all proportional to the radius of the tube, which is a point which I want to come back to later, because there are boundary layer effects which show that this maybe not should not be exactly proportional to the radius, but radius minus a millimeter or something like that. But anyhow, that's the, so you can see there is some variability in the data, but it's really fairly. I think that's it's good enough for to fit to a model like this. So that's the point. With an organ pipe, because I grew up with optics. please have a. In fact, a flute is better. A flute, I think, is better because the flute you do indeed get a node at one end and an antinode at the other end. Right. So. You can have both. Okay, I'm not. Well, this is all important in comparison. Not really, no. Because I don't want to give away all the answers. There's an important point, it's not related to the Kuntz tube. So this is now, the next thing we discover, this is oscillations. Now for this, we have to click on it and you'll see this phenomenon, which, is it doing something? Hey, why is it not working now? It worked a few minutes ago. What's happened to your computer? Why didn't it work? Well, can maybe I do enter or something? Yeah, this is a film. Go. Page. Up. Down. Oh! Ah, no, that went to the previous one. Page. I'm. Hey! It worked! It worked before the lecture! Aye! What? Oh! Press. What do I press? To get it. Maybe it will work when it's. This is.
This is. Copied it from the disk and it's probably linked to the disk.
Ah, yeah, that was on the disk. No, it wouldn't have cost that. Oh, that's the. Okay, that's a great pity. Okay. Okay, well. Sorry? Could you get the disk is on my. Bring all the four disks you see there. And yeah. Okay. Well. Okay. I don't want to believe me. I want you to see the evidence.
I believe that it worked for you, but still foolish.
Yes. Okay. Okay. So this is a set of pictures. You see, I was ready for this that the film wouldn't work. That have the stills. This is a time sequence going down the page here, and you can see that this case were actually two bands at the ends and one in the middle. And this works just as well if there were a band at one end and a space at the other end. And as time goes on, and this is a matter of about 20 seconds period, 10 seconds period, 10 seconds period. And you can see that this band splits into two, and this one moves off, these move off the ends to form two new bands here. And then this split into two goes back to the original, and you get these oscillations. So it oscillates between the two possible states, taking into account the possibility that the boundary conditions are either a band or halfway between the bands. But, thank you.
So you have two traveling waves, essentially.
It's like two, yes, with different frequencies. Which one has he taken?
Oh, I don't know.
That's the PowerPoint one. This was the one we saw, it worked on. Everything worked on this one.
Shall we run it then directly from the disk and hope for the best?
Well, I suppose.
Let's try. Okay, technical.
Sorry about the this. The newcomer to this field.
So I'm going to kill this talk and we'll start it up again.
Yes, okay. Any more questions? Well.
When do you get yourself?
We get these oscillations almost always. It's not complete. In fact, the previous slide with the data points on it, there were black ones and white ones. The black ones were when there were oscillations.
But I suppose there are oscillations,
then
what you were showing
us
were snapshots?
What I showed was a set of snapshots of stretched out so that so they would put one under the other.
But I don't understand. You always chose the extrema of the oscillation?
No. There was one at the extreme, and then there's one in the middle, where you could see the bands are divided into two. And then they joined, and when they joined up again. Yes, they're static pictures. There was one in the.
Well, they were extrema.
Right, thank you. Now let's see if we can get it to work. So.
We choose
extrema and halfway.
Well, okay.
Now let's see if it works. Well, I've got the mouse the wrong way up. I'm getting panicky. Now, no, it's making the right sort of noises. Here we go. Okay. So this is what you, this is the. Thank you very much. The combined efforts. Now you can see. So you can see they divide into two, and then they recombine in the other alternative. There seem to be there are two possibilities for the banding, and it goes backwards and forwards between one and the other. Sorry? Oh, if I increase it. I don't know, we haven't done enough experiments, but it seems to work in most cases. I'll show you when it doesn't, the case.
When it
oscillates. When the pattern, the wavelength is too far from what we'll see later is an ideal wavelength. That is when it's at the edge of the oscillation band, I think, but I'm not sure. But most cases it does oscillate. Okay. So, there, thank you for your patience. Okay, so we'll go. Oh, sorry, that's. Okay. The particle rotation phase are about 0.9 of the cylinder rotation rates, yes. About a little bit more than that, even. So this was the set of static pictures, and the idea which, after talking about this with all sorts of colleagues, in fact, it was the astrophysicist who helped me with this most. And one of our astrophysicists suggested it has something to do with Rossby waves. Now, Rossby waves are an atmospheric phenomenon caused in which you get waves with a restoring force caused by Coriolis force in the atmosphere. They cause oscillations in the atmosphere and bad weather when an easterly airstream crosses an obstacle. And that is an east-going airstream, a west wind, so to speak, crosses an obstacle. The Coriolis force is the restoring force in this case, and they are solution of the Navier-Stokes equations in the rotating frame of reference. So we looked at these waves, and now I'll give you the sort of theoretical part of this, and then we'll compare it with the experiments. So this is the Navier-Stokes equations with the Coriolis force, with the Coriolis force put in, and you should notice this is a dot here. This is because of a technical fault, which I know about that. The P star is a equivalent pressure, and you should take into account that G is oscillatory in this thing, because we've gone into the rotating frame of reference, and so gravity is now an oscillating force, not a constant force. And you get... this is the geometry of simply Navier-Stokes in rotating frame of reference. So what you add on to the left-hand side of the... No, there's no cylinder yet. Infinite medium. We'll put in the boundary conditions in a moment. But this is the equation. Rho g is down here. Why? Because this is a force. And the hydrodynamic terms are on the left, and on the right you have viscosity, the external force, and rho g coming in. Sorry? Why rho? Yes, I suppose you have to look at this as a rho is a function of position. Yes. So you take out the centrifugal force by a very well-known transformation. You can also take out the gravity in the same way, and you get this equation here. I think there was a 2 missing on the previous one, but anyhow, this is the right equation. Well, this is just the simplest case, where we've taken out the viscosity and we've left the pressure dependent term, and there can be an external force on it as well. So now, looking, if you put in an oscillatory variation of the pressure, like a frequency omega, then you get this equation. And this, you know, this is the sort of equation which everybody knows how to solve from electromagnetic theory. Now, a sideline, there were three authors. Rotating frame of reference. I've written. the rotation axis is Z, that's correct, yes. And this is just a translation of that to a cylindrical coordinates. And as I say, everybody knows how to solve these equations. Gravity is a rotating force now in the XY plane. XY plane, that's right. XY.
So where did rho go?
Where?
Rho
sort of cancels out in most of this, because we've written it in terms of the pressure, you see. By doing this transformation to the pressure, it all comes out very easily. This is all standard things in hydrodynamics, no new tricks here. And now, a short anecdote, there are three authors on this paper. Why I'm one of them, the other is my graduate student who's working on this, and the third is a string theorist, very appropriate for this meeting, a string theorist who I talked with this, but the importance of having a coffee room. I was telling him about this, asking him what I was doing, and he was a visitor in our department. And I was telling him what I was doing, and he said, "Oh, I'm just writing a textbook on electromagnetic theory, because I feel that Jackson is out of date, and it's about time there's a new book." So I said, "Oh, well, maybe you can actually help us to solve these equations." And he got really involved in this, and forgot about writing his book. He came on sabbatical to our department for a semester in order to write his book. And in fact, all the rest of the work now, the theory part, is his really. I mean, I did the work, but he checked it, and he got all the mistakes out of it, which was the important thing. So we have string theory to thank for the calculation here. Sorry, Jerry Franklin from Temple University. If we assume, now just to make things simple, that the frequency of rotation is equal to the frequency of the particles rotate is equal to the frequency of the tube, which may not be exactly true. In fact, we've seen experimentally it's not quite true. But to make things simpler, we've put this in. In fact, this k here, gamma over k is slightly different if the frequency is different. No particles at all. This is fluid dynamics now.
So
no.
If you just assume that the solution of the positive is not a small omega, but it's small omega equals the big omega.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's
no words are just interpretation.
Yes.
This is what you actually
Exactly. We put it into these equations, and you get a series of solutions, just like in a cylindrical waveguide. And you get these solutions. Sorry? Gamma is simply a factor which comes into here, Jm of gamma r. And gamma is equal to k times root 3. Or the other way. Sorry? The density is constant.
Right now,
we're now looking at the fluid, in fact. We're looking at the fluid. Yes, this is pure. Incidentally, this problem was solved by Kelvin many years ago. So he said there's nothing new in this. It was solved by Kelvin, but nobody seems to have noticed the answers to it. Someone in 1953 did an experiment and showed that it was right, and this is all we could find on the whole subject of these waves. So far it's just a number which I've put in order to define a wave. Just like you do in electromagnetic theory, you define a K for your electromagnetic waves. Now we'll put them into the waveguide. So this is just the same as you got before, which we've actually put the velocities in. Before it was the pressure. Now we've got into the velocities. And Ym equals minus 1. I've just written it for the minus 1 moment.
You see, what this is you have a cylinder, you have a fluid rotating in there, and you solve the Navier-Stokes equation.
Yes.
You show us the set of possible solutions.
That's right. Yeah.
And usually, without particles, it wouldn't select them.
That's right. But the particles cause it to select a particular solution. Right. So Ym equals minus 1. This is exactly the point. M equals minus 1 because if you look at this thing up here, it's sine theta plus omega t. That's actually sine theta minus m omega t. And we put m equals minus 1. This gives you a solution which is stationary in the lab frame. That was the important thing. This m equals minus 1 solution is stationary in the lab frame because it's going exactly at minus omega. And then, so now we're going to put in the boundary conditions. And these are radial velocity is zero on the curved surfaces, and the longitudinal velocity zero at the ends. So we put in those conditions, and then you have an eigenvalue equation, and we can compare that with the experimental results. Where's the cursor? Yeah. So, the linearization was a long time ago when we forgot about the nonlinear terms. Yeah. I better go back because. The first solution of this, there are a series of solutions with n equals minus 1, but the first solution for the zero of this Bessel function equation is gamma, where wavelength is 3.97 R. So that's we'll now look at the experimental results. That's where 3.97 comes up there. So you can see these things don't go around the 3.97 line; they hang from it for some reason. This is one of the unexplained points here. On the other hand, if I assume that the frequency of rotation is not equal to the rate of rotation, then you put in the new value of omega, then it brings that line. You can put that line where you like. And so the reason may be that when you solve the equations for the interaction between the particles and the fluid, then it will you get a different frequency and a different frequency omega, which is different from big omega, and it will be around that better.
So how many particles do you need? Is one enough?
No, you need a lot. At least 20 per band is about the limit at which this starts. Yeah, if it's less than that, there is no effect. You don't get a small number of particles which statistically inhabit the bands. It just, the whole thing goes away, they're completely random. It starts with about 20 particles per band. And so this all fits very nicely, and you say, okay, so you found this wave, these particles, it's just like the Kunst tube, they like to sit in the nodes, but that's not true, because it's, what comes out is that the
particles.
Sorry? Fluid is the fluid, is the water. Not, no, we've just so far looked only at the fluid. I haven't got the interaction in, and that's, I'll disappoint you, we haven't yet got there. This is why I want to talk to our friends here about particle interaction, fluid interactions, to see how we put this in. So
the three solutions look like really in our
roles. Well, you'll see what the solutions look like. Just a moment. Just a moment. You're just one slide ahead of me all the time. So the thing is that this means that the particles sit in alternate nodes, and that's why you can get the two patterns which shift from one to the other, because the wavelength comes out equal to the banding length, and not half of it. But you remember now, if you go back to that sort of viscous approximation at the beginning, it was half of the banding, and there I believe they do sit in all the nodes, and it's just like a Kunst tube. But in this case it isn't. They sit in alternate things. Now, if you go look at the fluid velocity in the nodal planes, then you have two possibilities. This is one of them. In the lab, this A is in the lab frame. This is what it looks like in the rotating frame. This is what it looks like in the lab frame. For you can see the planes K, let's say the even planes. And there you can see there's a rotation of the fluid which matches very nicely what we see with the particles. And we got that movement of the particles by considering no wave, just a particle moving around in the fluid itself. If we go to the other planes, that is the halfway planes, then you get the opposite. And now the fluid, you see the center of the fluid motion has now moved offset to the other side of the center. It doesn't match the particle motion. And that's why I think with the large particles, the particles only like to be in in the even bands and not in the odd bands. Now, of course, there's an equivalent solution in which odd and even are interchanged, and that's the other one, so that's why it can shift from one to the other. And if the small omega is not equal to big omega, you in fact get a solution in which the two types, the whole thing rotates so that sometimes it would be like this and sometimes it would be like the other solution with a beat frequency equal to the difference between little omega and big omega. Why is it off-center? Because it's a superposition of a linear flow, but the previous slide showed that. better. See, that's the that's a solution in the rotating frame. That's symmetric, but it's going up. And the next plane, it's going down. So when you add this to the rotating one, you get off-center to the left or the right.
Can I go back to the very first
Yes.
Where the levitating so-called showed a radius.
Yes.
Which depended on its mass.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the relation to this?
The center here matches. That's that point. And the particles in general, if you have a number of particles, they rotate around that point. And it also seems to be a stable solution. But that's you will get one or two of those particles that will sit there, but in fact they prefer to be in a disk going around it.
The micrographic.
So that point you can calculate just by
I think that this point, of course, it depends on the that point is determined by the rate of rotation of the tube and the mass of the particle. And this solution here depends on the amplitude of the pressure wave. And the amplitude of the pressure wave is not given. It's a variable. So I assume that the amplitude of the pressure wave, since it's very, very small pressure, adjusts itself so as to fit this pattern here.
So you haven't predicted this. You've just illustrated. There's a whole family.
That's right.
Of solutions.
Right. Okay.
With
different positions. Yes. Yeah. You see this amplitude of this velocity.
That's will be chosen by the nonlinear curve.
Yes. That I agree with, except that I have no evidence to show that it's true. I agree it's probably going to be. Yes, that's what I would expect to come out of the nonlinear.
You are in the rotating frame.
This is the rotating frame. Well, it could be up. In one, it's going to be up. Next one, it's going to be down. Maybe if I show the next picture, you'll see why. Because you have, if you look at it from the other direction, wait a minute. In the rotating frame. Well, you can freeze it, and at any particular moment, it will look like this one. Okay. So this is what you were asking about for the motion in the the static motion. This is what the fluid motion looks like, rolls, in the rotating frame. But it's oscillatory, and so that at the in the lab frame you actually get a packed picture which looks like that. And that's why your particles like to be in this plane where they catch the upgoing fluid. And the bubbles like to be in that plane where they catch the downgoing fluid. So they separate into these two. So, and then the ends of the tube have to be where Vz equals zero, so they'll be here and here, for example. Anywhere where the and that's where you get the resonant effect.
Well, I mean, I'm still confused about the general scheme with respect to the answer. It doesn't appear on this picture, it's only the relationship of this picture
to the lab frame,
which
depends
on the amplitude.
I think the amplitude is determined by the interaction with the particles.
And the amplitude doesn't come in.
It doesn't come in here.
But it does in the lab frame.
In the lab frame, it has to come in because it has to give you the right radius of the neutral point. Has to be at the right radius from the center to match what the particles want to do if there were no wave. And so where we got to now, I've got to that's as far as I can go with calculating things. Now, what's left are the problems, the oscillations. Well, as I said, one solution, one possibility for the oscillations is that the particles are rotating at a slightly different frequency from the tube because they're always falling with respect to the fluid, so they go around a little slower. That, in fact, determines the frequency, little omega, and that's beat between that little omega and the big omega gives you this same pattern, but oscillating in sine. So the upward flowing region oscillates between one node and the other. That's probably the solution, but this is hand waving. I want to see this worked out.
The viscous drag.
The viscous drag is what keeps saying. That's true, and so far, and this is now we've got to the region where we're doing the experiments, and we haven't got good data on this yet. The effect of this is on the effect of the viscosity, so we'd expect, and then at some stage, you see the particles, if the viscosity is high enough, these particles act just like tracers, in which they have really no. The rate at which they come to the particle comes to equilibrium with the local flow is short. The time is short compared with the period of the rotation, and then you get particles just trapped in the flow. And in fact, you can see all of these things. First of all, the particles mainly get trapped in both types of node, and this is when you get the period equal to the diameter of the tube. And in addition, when you get to really high level velocities, you can actually see this rolls. Looking at the XZ plane. So I think that that sort of picture is reasonably good. Look at the question of why the data sort of hangs off that line, hangs off the line wavelength over the radius equal to 3.97 and doesn't sit symmetrically around it, may have to do with the viscous forces. If I put in a force, remember the equation had an F in it, I can put in this form of force, which is just viscous drag, and then you find that the gamma over K, instead of being nicely, gamma over K was root 3 before. But you can see now, if you have this alpha coming in, it comes out a little different from root 3, and that could explain it too. I'm not sure yet of what the right answer is here. Yeah. Okay, but what determines little omega, you see? So it's this force which determines little omega. So it may actually be the same sort of thing. We see nothing in this nuclear void. The best thing for them is to go round with the fluid and stay where they are. You see, it's just like parts of the fluid. So there's the conclusions that we have. The banding was observed. Period is determined approximately by the radius of the tube and exactly by the length of the tube. It's a resonant phenomenon. And it seems that the waves involved are inertial waves in the fluid. And the patterns more or less agree with this theoretical approach. And the oscillations, which say we're not going to make any too definite decisions about that. Okay, thank you. Yes, well, when we get to the stage where there's a fairly high velocity, to change the viscosity, you mean?
Well,
that it's not viscosity.
Well,
it's so easy to do these experiments, so anything can be done. Yeah. That's well. That would be interesting to try. Okay. Well, honey is a bit too. Well, you have steel balls and honey, or something like that, maybe.
Slowly, yes. You can. Yeah. The product train.
Yes. Yes. The length of the tube. The length of the tube is the control. Was the control parameter?
Yeah,
nothing else seemed to affect it.
But if you change it,
okay.
You will get another.
That's right. It's not exactly control parameter. It takes you out of the regime. If you change the viscosity, then we'll get into a new regime where we have different Reynolds numbers and different and so on. And then we have to start looking more carefully at the solutions to the equations. But so long as we're in this region of where we can consider it more as an inertial effect than a viscous effect, then I think that the viscosity is not a control parameter.
So what's the small parameter
the velocity is not very small
compared
with the rotation velocity r times omega. I compare it with that at the edge of the tube. That's the largest value of the velocity, and I think that the velocities involved in these waves are not that small compared with that. I said the Rossby number. is about 0.5, which means that the non-linear term can't be really neglected, and that's where I think all the fun is going to come in.
But Pierre's saying there seems to be, you said experimentally, there's an onset. You say as soon as they lift off the ground.
Oh, they say lift off the ground. I've never thought of that point. That just seemed to be sort of obvious that they would come off the ground at some point. I never thought what controls it. If well, that must involve the viscosity somehow. There may never be any linear region. That's unless the viscosity gets so high that. No, I'm not sure. Whether there's ever a. Maybe there's never a linear region.
I could achieve the same if I take a mechanic ball. So I take a ball as thin as a steel ball, which can roll on the wall.
Yes.
And I take a huge magnet, which keeps this ball on the wall. Mm-hmm. And the ball never lifts off, it just breaks the symmetry of my cylinder.
Yeah, maybe.
And it stays stationary, okay. I could select the same...
Maybe. The interesting thing about these waves is that they've always been considered so boring that no one's ever done anything about them. As I say, the last experiment we found done on these things was in 1953 or 50. They looked at the Green's function, actually. They create the waves in a rotating fluid. They have a tube, a vertical tube of water. They have an oscillating ball in the middle, which is oscillated mechanically from outside, and they have tracer particles in the fluid. What you see is the way in which the wavefront propagates. It actually propagates at an angle, because you have two frequencies in this, the rate of rotation and the frequency of the wave. They're independent now, they're not connected. So that in those experiments you can actually see the wavefront of the waves and it zigzags backwards and forwards up the tube. It appears in all the standard books on hydrodynamics. And that's where they finish with the subject, except for meteorology, where you get Rossby waves in the atmosphere and so on. No. Okay. These are the questions which I don't know yet. I believe this is part of the nonlinear theory which we have to develop for this, of why the particles. Because really, we've not considered the particles at all. This is a fluid, this is just a simple fluid, and we said now, because the particles themselves would move because of viscous forces in a certain way, then it will match match the way in which the water moves. That's where they prefer to be. But this sort of gives them a. Well, I'd be very happy to. Yes. Okay. I missed your talk because I just arrived last Monday, so I just missed it. I think that's the sort of thing which I wanted to learn about, so that we can take this one stage further. Then we tried to eject dye. We didn't see anything. We didn't see anything with the dye. We hoped maybe to see these cones of the wavefront propagation, but we didn't see anything with that. And we have recently put in, with the higher viscosities, you can see the motion much more easily, and you can really see what's going on inside in the tube, and it fits exactly this sort of description.
Thanks, Steve, again. And
thank you.
Remember, we are back here too.
Thank you for the use of your.
Thank you for warming it up.